In November, Ohio voters enshrined reproductive rights, including the right to an abortion, into the state constitution. But the current state of reproductive rights in the state remains murky, as laws that abortion rights advocates say restrict access remain on the books. The ACLU of Ohio and Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit to eliminate some of those restrictions, including a 24-hour mandatory waiting period. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Today, we speak with an attorney with the ACLU of Ohio and a reporter covering this issue about the current state of abortion access in Ohio and nationwide. Later, we talk to IdeaStream education reporter Connor Morris about his sit-down with Youngstown State University President Bill Johnson. They talk about the controversy surrounding him and his plans for the university, including how to boost enrollment. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. In the 2 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it's been up to states to determine abortion access through legislation, the ballot box, and the courts. In November, Ohio voters enshrined reproductive rights, including the right to abortion, in the Ohio Constitution. But the access parameters are still murky. Some laws remain on the books that contradict the new amendment. For instance, the ACLU of Ohio and Planned Parenthood recently announced a lawsuit to eliminate a mandatory 24-hour waiting period before patients can access abortion care, among other regulations they call discriminatory restrictions. And nationally, the state of abortion access could be impacted by the U.S. Supreme Court that will decide whether or not the Food and Drug Administration's approval of a common medication abortion pill can stand. This hour, we'll start by discussing where things stand 5 months after the passage of Issue 1 in Ohio and discuss where abortion access stands nationwide as well. Joining me in studio for the conversation is Jesse Hill, law professor at Case Western Reserve University and cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio. Jesse, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. And by phone, we have Susan Tebben, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Susan, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for being here. I'm happy to be here.
If you would like to join the conversation or have a question for Jesse or Susan, you can call toll-free 866-578-0903 or email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Jesse, just within the week, Arizona Supreme Court made news for allowing a law dating back to the 1860s to take effect that would be a near total abortion ban. And Florida Supreme Court approved a 6-week abortion ban this month. So now Ohio has a similar legislature to these states that are Republican controlled, Republican dominated. Yet we have a different situation to what's happening in those states, and that's due to Issue 1. So kind of elaborate more about how Ohio is unique from those states that have just passed these very restrictive bans.
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's right. I mean, after Dobbs, of course, every state now is free to set its own abortion policy, essentially. And so what's different about Ohio is that, and this is really unique across the country, that Ohio is the first state, which, you know, you might call it a red state or just a state where the legislature, the executive, and a majority of the state Supreme Court have all been hostile to abortion. And yet we enshrined this positive protection for reproductive rights into our state constitution. So, you know, there right now, the state of the law is kind of what it was pre-Dobbs in Ohio, in that, you know, we do have legal abortion access, but it is still heavily restricted. But because of Issue 1, the state has not been able to enforce a ban on abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, which was in effect for a short period after Dobbs.
So if you're a woman who's facing that decision of getting an abortion, just kind of what is the state of that? So you can get one after 6 weeks,
Yeah, in Ohio, abortion is legal and accessible up to 22 weeks of pregnancy, but it is still very heavily restricted. And that is one of the issues that we are going after in this lawsuit is that, you know, it's very burdensome. There are all these sort of state-imposed obstacles in the path of somebody who wants to get that kind of reproductive health care. So, you know, you have to, for example, go in person. You know, you have to make an appointment, go in person to a clinic to get your various information and provide consent. And then after, you know, all that is done and you know you want this procedure, this because of the state laws, you have to go home, wait 24 hours, and then, you know, come back to access care. And, you know, it's and frankly, it often ends up being much more than 24 hours for a lot of people because you can't always just come back 24 hours later. People, there may not be appointments. People have childcare challenges, work, you know, transportation, things like that. So you know, and that's just one example of numerous barriers that are in state law to accessing abortion in Ohio.
And Susan, why don't you take us back a little bit further? Because I think if you work in this space or, you know, are familiar with what's happening, there's just been a lot of moving parts when it comes to abortion access in the state over the past couple of years, you know, with the overturning of Roe v. Wade as well. So what does that landscape and the changes look like over the last 2 years?
Yeah, so I mean, you have clearly a galvanization of the voters who have seen, you know, what's been happening in the state and said, you know, 57% of the voters in November said issue one, we approve it and we want abortion to be legal. And we want to see that here in Ohio. And that matches with, you know, the trends that we've seen in polling, the trends that we've seen in voters over the last few years. And then, as Jesse's saying, we're also seeing, you know, a legislature that is red, supermajority. So we're seeing them sort of say, you know, we're having specific Rep. Jennifer Gross who's saying, I am not going to uphold that part of the Ohio Constitution. I did not take an oath for that, and in future oaths, I will not be upholding that. And seeing legislation come up that has not been passed yet, but we're still seeing legislation that is looking to undermine that issue one and say, you know, the authority for issue one should be within the legislature rather than the judiciary, you know, taking up all of these court cases and things and sort of throwing them up in the air should this be passed. The House Speaker has said that this is not an issue that they plan to take up. But, you know, if you have enough of people within the legislature saying these things, it sort of gets around. And we're getting concerns from the public and from advocates about, you know, what is going to happen within the legislature. So you see both of those sides. You see, you know, advocacy groups, abortion rights groups being overwhelmed with, you know, the need for support, but also being overwhelmed with people who need the help, and they don't know exactly what the abortion rights are in Ohio because it's been so confusing, even though we have issue one in place. You know, they don't know, well, we've had all these lawsuits. Where are we really? So it's good to, you know, have these sorts of discussions to be able to get the information out to the public while we're still seeing this stuff sort of in flux, but not in flux, but maybe in the future might be.
Yeah, and so, Jesse, I think that's the whole point of our having this conversation. And like Susan said, you know, there's clarity that the public is looking for, especially when there's so much kind of posturing and just rhetoric that we hear. And we don't know what is law and what is, you know, the desires of, let's say, the public versus politicians, yada, yada. Susan wrote an email from Willowick that says, sadly, it seems that the legislators in Ohio are in no hurry to repeal the laws contrary to issue one. So why didn't issue one just take these laws off the books? Why didn't it work like a, you know, I don't know, a magic marker of new legislation, a new policy?
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, that's not exactly how it works. So, in fact, Ohio, you know, Ohioans did vote by this overwhelming margin enshrined in our Constitution, this robust protection for reproductive freedom. But then, you know, what happens next? Well, there are a couple of options. You know, one thing is the legislature could say, okay, we now understand Ohioans are saying they want us out of their health care. Let's repeal all of these abortion bans and restrictions that have been on the books because, you know, that's the will of the people. We don't have a legislature that is willing to do that, right? So, you know, we could have the attorney general saying, you know, we agree these laws are now not enforceable. So go ahead and you know, we can just act as though they are not, you know, they are not on the books anymore. We don't have an attorney general who's going to say that. So, you know, unfortunately, we're in the position of having to do this kind of the hard way, which means we have to bring lawsuits to ensure that basically court orders exist saying that these laws can't be enforced. And actually, our attorney general, Dave Yost, has on the record explicitly said we are going to act as though every law that's on the books is enforceable until a court tells us otherwise. So,
but what was his position on the 6-week ban?
Yeah, I mean, he agreed that the 6-week ban was now unconstitutional under the new amendment, but that's not the end of the story because there's a lawsuit around that ban. It has been blocked. The ban has been blocked, you know, since before the amendment, actually. But that lawsuit's still ongoing, and the Attorney General's office is saying, yes, the ban itself is unconstitutional, but they're continuing to defend kind of other provisions in the law. And so even that lawsuit is still ongoing, is still not over yet.
That's so interesting. Again, if you have a question or a comment to make, please, we'd love to hear from you. It's 866-578-0903 or soi@ideastream.org to drop us an email. We've got some experts here who have all the answers, which I love because, you know, I feel like I'm with the masses in kind of feeling confused about what's happening in Ohio when it comes to abortion access. So let me ask you this, Susan, issue one. It did enshrine abortion access into the Constitution and other reproductive rights. So when Alabama's Supreme Court ruled last month that frozen embryos were considered children and put in vitro fertilization into a tenuous state, you reported that this likely wouldn't impact Ohio's laws due in part to Issue 1 protections. But again, as you said, we have a red supermajority. So what has their conversation been regarding IVF and what is the state of that in Ohio?
Yeah, so as you said, Issue 1 does protect that and does have specific protections for fertility treatments, which a lot of people, you know, maybe don't think about that in terms of this amendment really was a reproductive health amendment. It does mention abortion. Abortion is, of course, one of the key tenets of it, but there is other stuff involved in it, miscarriage care, which can be called a spontaneous abortion when you're talking in medical terms, and things like that. So fertility treatment is one of the things that is specifically mentioned within the issue one, the amendment. So it is protected right now, but that doesn't mean that there isn't concern. You know, you have all of these issues across the country. You even have the U.S. Supreme Court talking about mifepristone, which is used for medication abortions, used for miscarriage treatment. In terms of they're talking about whether the FDA approval should stay the way they are. And so you have all of these things that are sort of like, oh, that's not in Ohio, that's not happening here.
Right.
But you have to, and as doctors are looking at it and advocates are looking at this, you know, we can't assume that, you know, there's a wall up against this stuff just because of issue one, because we even have our own legislature trying to see, you know, what will stick, if we can get around it, what can we do? So, you know, all of these things are being looked at as, you know, this is a concern because IVF is a big deal. And there are a lot of, you know, you're talking about, this is sort of the opposite of the anti-abortion argument, that saying, you know, these are the people that want to have children and they want to be able to do it, but they haven't been able to do it in, you know, necessarily the traditional way, let's say.
Sure.
So they need the ability to have these options in place. And if you're talking about this in terms of, you know, a morality issue or something like that, you have to keep an eye on all of these things. And, you know, all the legislatures, you know, have these different groups that they'll talk to that are national groups. So if we have talking points coming down from a national group, then that could definitely be something that's discussed in Ohio. And it's something that the House Speaker, specifically about IVF and embryos, has said, we don't have any specific plans to go after it. And he, in fact, said that he considers that to be a pro-life issue. However, you just cannot be too careful when you're talking about these kinds of issues. And so everybody's sort of, you know, bracing and making sure that we're watching what's happening with this stuff, because, you know, you just never know what's going to show up all of a sudden, especially when we're, you know, it's such a hot button issue.
I just think for the families, let's say, that are potentially going through IVF, or the doctors who practice in this vein, you know, kind of that climate or cloak of fear and just trepidation about the fact that you never know when it's going to become a hot political button issue to go after these types of things. And it changes the landscape of what you can or cannot do legally as a practicing doctor or as, you know, the patient. You know, it's so interesting. Jesse, you wanted to add to what Susan was saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that's exactly right. And that's the kind of climate that abortion providers have been operating under for a very long time in Ohio. You know, the legislators can say they're not going after IVF, but in Alabama, it was an Alabama Supreme Court ruling that actually changed the law there, and it wasn't the legislature. So, I mean, I think when issue one was being debated before the election, some folks who were opposed to it said, you know, this is all about abortion and all of this other stuff, contraception, miscarriage care, fertility care. That's just, you know, that's just a head fake. Those things are not under attack at all. And now we've seen, it's been very interesting with the Alabama decision that fertility care can be impacted. We had the case of Brittany Watts, who was seeking miscarriage care and denied in Ohio. And so, you know, to say that none of these things are really under threat is just not true. And I think that, you know, recent events have shown us that.
Yeah, and Jesse, such a good point made. Brittany Watts, you know, I mean, essentially, you know, vilified or criminalized for you know, dealing with a hospital administration that didn't know what to do when it came to what was an inevitable miscarriage. You know, just really seems to be like a double victim in some capacities. What do you think clinics, hospitals are currently feeling when it comes to existing within this gray area in Ohio when it comes to abortion? How are they proceeding, and how is that affecting patients?
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation still because, again, we continue to have these sort of vague laws on the books. Doctors are not lawyers expert at interpreting these laws. On the other hand, the lawyers are not doctors who are good at, you know, understanding moment-by-moment clinical situations. So, and all of these, at least abortion-related laws, are backed up by really serious criminal penalties if you run afoul of them. So this is part of why it's so important not just to say, okay, you know, abortion is legal after issue one, but really to go after these restrictions that are on the books, that are creating confusion, that are, you know, still harming patients until we can get them blocked in the courts.
I am currently talking to Jesse Hill, law professor at Case Western Reserve University and cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio, and Susan Tebben, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. We're talking about the current state of abortion access in the state of Ohio and in the country. Again, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, 866-578-0903, or email us at soi@ideastream.com. You can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Susan, what are you hearing in your reporting from doctors and clinics about the state of gray in Ohio when it comes to abortion access?
Well, as you're saying, there's a sowing of confusion, even within the medical community. Of you know, even when we saw pre-issue one, you know, there was that sowing of confusion of what kind of paperwork do we need to fill out, even, you know, how long do we have to wait to decide what we're doing in terms of providing services for these, you know, it's like you've trained all your life and gone through medical school and all this stuff, and what's hampering you is this legislation and is this waiting periods and confusion about, you know, can I make a medical decision that I feel I am, you know, medically, I have studied for and I know what to do, you know, I've trained for. So you had that, and then we're still seeing that afterwards. We're still having doctors that are saying, you know, we know that we have issue one, we know that we have this stuff, but we still have a 24-hour waiting period. We still have these transfer agreements, which means that you, if you work with a providing, with an abortion providing facility, that there are certain distances that you can be from a hospital to be able to be admitted into a hospital. So doctors are facing those things as well. And you're talking about, like I said, the U.S. Supreme Court talking about medication abortion and FDA approvals that have been originally in place since 24 years ago, but now they're looking at changing that and going back to that. So, you know, it's making doctors look at this like a broader public health crisis in terms of, you know, what other medications are we going to start talking about? Are we going to start talking about, you know, heart attack medicines? Are we talking about, you know, what other medical treatments are we going to be sort of putting under the microscope now in terms of a judicial and a lawsuit landscape, rather than are these actually working in a medical sense? And are these the medicines and treatments that our patients need to live their lives?
Yeah, and I'll just jump in with one other example. Susan was mentioning the abortion medication, mifepristone. You know, in Ohio, the laws restrict that medication even beyond what federal law, the restrictions imposed by federal law. So, you know, in many places, this can be safely used up to 11 weeks of pregnancy. Ohio cuts it off at 10 weeks. You know, it can't be provided by anybody but a physician in Ohio. That's why you can't get it in the pharmacies right now, whereas you can in other states. So it's just another example of all the roadblocks.
So Jesse, let's get further into your lawsuit, because, you know, some might say 24 hours, is that really an onus? But tell us more about the nuances of a 24-hour waiting period. You know, and I was reading more about it, and the idea that, you know, there might be information given to a woman that tries to dissuade or persuade in a certain direction, and the fact that, I mean, it seems like your position is that shouldn't be happening at all.
Right. I mean, first of all, I want to say, you know, 24 hours, that may not sound like a big deal, but we're talking about healthcare that someone has already decided that they want. They've already gone through the informed consent process. They've already, you know, made an appointment, gone to a clinic. You know, I mean, people don't need another. Maybe they've traveled many miles, and because there are not that many clinics in Ohio, you know, people don't need another 24 hours. When, if you have an unintended pregnancy, you've probably been thinking about nothing else. You don't need the state to say, now go home and think about it a little bit more, right? These are you know, competent decision makers. These are adults we're talking about. And I think, so that's one piece of it. Also, as I mentioned, it's often a much longer delay. People who have lower incomes, who have, you know, various difficulties in their lives, may really struggle to make a couple of trips, to miss work, to lose wages, things like that. So there's that piece of it. The other thing is another piece of this law that we're challenging is that they require the physician to check whether there is a fetal heartbeat or, you know, embryonic heartbeat or cardiac activity, and to offer the patient the opportunity to hear it, and then to tell them what the probability would be that they carried the pregnancy to term based on that gestational age if they were not to have an abortion, which is just a certain bizarre information if you think about it, but also, you know, for certain patients, really, really painful and traumatic. People who have, for example, wanted pregnancies that, you know, are not going to survive, maybe there's a serious fetal diagnosis, you know, people who have been victims of sexual assault, being reminded of the date of their assault because they're told the gestational age, or saying, here, do you want to hear the heartbeat? You know, it can be really excessively cruel. I mean, I have a friend who told me, you know, she was miscarrying. She was devastated. And the doctor had to say, okay, would you like to hear the fetal heartbeat, you know, in the process of ending that pregnancy? And it was just you know, traumatic and cruel for no reason at all. So, you know, nobody is saying that patients shouldn't have that opportunity to, you know, take extra time. Of course, they can always take extra time to get the information if they want it. But these are laws that are inflexible, that force everybody to jump through these hoops, whether they need it or not. And it just shows that the state doesn't trust doctors or women to make these decisions and to use their best judgment. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And Susan, I mean, do you think there is kind of an aspect of this where it's as if the government saying we need to, you know, take care of our public who doesn't understand what they are or are not doing when it comes to their bodies and access to abortion?
I think there is the element of that in that they there is a morality portion to it, I think, in terms of legislators, certainly the legislators who've been outspoken about how they feel about abortion and issue one and those kinds of things have said, you know, this is an issue where you're essentially you're killing a child. And so the science of it sort of, again, we're talking about confusion. We're talking about legislators who have a firm belief that life begins at conception and have said that. And we have a firm belief that if you can detect, and medical science is, you know, not exactly clear on when fetal heartbeats start, but there is medical science evidence that women may not know that they're even pregnant by 6 weeks. So, you know, you have the people that believe as soon as you have some sort of zygote in there, mm-hmm. that we have to protect it. And then you have the others who say this should be the decision of the person who has to hold on to it for 9 months. And the decision of the doctor that they trust to do this. So I think there's some sort of, there's a chasm in between that is hard, as certainly as a reporter, it's hard to bridge, to say you're sort of talking over each other in terms of, you know, one says you can't do anything to this, one says it should be my decision. And those aren't exactly the same arguments. So there has to be some sort of gap. But you also have, there's another point that I wanted to follow along with what Jesse was saying. In terms of the patients and how they're trying to get information, you have these facilities called crisis pregnancy centers. They can also be called pregnancy resource centers, that are typically religiously based. But they a lot of times portray themselves to be a place where you can go if you feel that you are pregnant, to get a pregnancy test, to maybe get an ultrasound. But a lot of these don't have a lot of medical background behind them. So a lot of them, certainly the ones that are religiously based, have a background of not promoting any kind of abortion. Don't give that as an option. What we're talking about is how you can bring this baby. Then they'll talk about it as a baby rather than a fetus or, you know, a potential for anything. How can we get you care, get you your car seats, get you all this stuff that we've already talked about, rather than talk about maybe the option of not having it?
Right.
So, and these are all portrayed as the same thing. You know, they might have white coats. They might have, you know, information that they give you, but the information might be from a medically debunked, you know, resource saying there's some that say, you know, breast cancer, the likelihood of breast cancer might go up if you have an abortion, if they even bring up the term of abortion. So we're having a lot of these confusion where people that are just trying to get information, that are trying to decide what they're going to do, might not even know what they're walking into when they're trying to just educate themselves. And like Jesse was saying, we don't have a lot of clinics left that are, you know, will provide abortion services or can provide abortion services. And we have these others with information that may or may not be accurate. So it's a lot for someone who's trying to figure out what they're going to do with their lives,
right,
to be able to decide. And then you have the legislature arguing about whether or not they should even have the control over it.
Right.
So it's a stressful time for them.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation about the state of abortion access in Ohio, and we're going to talk specifically about Supreme Court decisions November and how other states are navigating the post-Roe landscape. Once again, if you want to participate in the conversation, the number 866-578-0903, or you can email us at soi@ideastream.org. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. We'll be right back. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. Thanks for staying with us this hour. We're talking about the state of abortion access in Ohio post the November issue one vote that enshrined reproductive rights and the access to abortion into the state constitution. And yet the climate, it's still a little bit murky. The public doesn't quite know exactly what is going on when it comes to this issue. So we're trying to get some clarity with Jesse Hill, law professor at Case Western Reserve University and cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio, and Susan Tebman, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Now, Jesse, let's talk about the November presidential election and other elections that are happening in November and how that might impact the landscape in Ohio when it comes to abortion access.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's incredibly important on so many levels. I mean, first of all, at the presidential level, you know, it's really important for folks to be aware that if an administration is elected that is hostile to abortion, and it's pretty clear that, you know, a Trump administration, a Republican administration would be, there are lots of things they can do to prohibit abortion access, even in places like Ohio, where we have, you know, this constitutional amendment. And, you know, one thing that has come up quite a bit is something called the Comstock Act, a law from the 19th century that another one of these 19th century laws that folks who are opposed to abortion have said that can be enforced now nationwide and could be really essentially a nationwide abortion ban. So, I mean, already, even just at that level, so much hinges on the election. And then there's also a hugely consequential state Supreme Court race in Ohio. And I really urge people to, listeners to educate themselves on where the candidates stand on the issues that they care about, including this one, because there are three seats up for election in November. And it really could impact whether we have a pro-choice or an anti-abortion majority on that court as well.
And Susan, I mean, what have legislators or any kind of candidates running have said about November in Ohio and access to abortion?
Yeah, so I've been covering that Supreme Court race that Jesse's talking about. And it's an interesting thing because they are really trying to be nonpartisan, because those roles are technically supposed to be nonpartisan in the state Supreme Court. But they're also having a struggle where they also need to sort of take a stand in terms of, I'm not going to be swayed one way or the other, meaning I'm not going to be swayed toward the anti-abortion side or the pro-abortion side. But it's definitely a discussion that they're going to have, because the Supreme Court has already taken up, say, in the six-week abortion ban lawsuit, there was an appeal from the state to try to keep the six-week abortion ban going while they had the lawsuit, which that actually got struck down by the state Supreme Court, because they said due to a change in law, which people think means because of issue one, they didn't want to try to take that up. And as we've seen Attorney General Dave Yost saying, that part is not enforceable. So it sort of matches up with so we've seen some decisions already from the state Supreme Court related to abortion. We even saw them, making decisions in terms of even how the ballot initiative showed up on the ballots for Ohioans. So there's a lot to say there about that, and a lot for them to decide on. I'm sure there will be future issues that they'll have to decide on. And we have, legislators that have been very clear on which side of the aisle they stand on. Like I said, Jennifer Gross is not going to make any oaths to issue one. And we have plenty of people that are saying we, believe in the national abortion ban that could be 15 weeks and that kind of thing. So fortunately for a reporter, we have people being very clear about where they stand as for, what that means in terms of voters and what legislation that's going to come forward. We'll have to wait and see. But that Supreme Court race is going to be an important one to see in terms of if legislation comes along and if people like Jesse come along and sue against it, then we have could see appeals go up to the state Supreme Court, which will make that very impactful.
Tom in Cleveland wrote, I think the only way to achieve, I think he's saying the execution of issue one, is to elect more Democrats to all positions this year, and then issue one will be secured. So, Jesse, I want to get your impressions. Is it a political tactic when, you're talking about the Comstock Act, and then you see in Arizona, my understanding is the law that was just passed regarding abortion in Arizona that includes, it's a total ban, includes incest and rape, and was initially implemented before Arizona was even a state. So is there a political tactic to the extremity of what we're seeing in some of these states?
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure what exactly the tactic or the strategy is for the folks who would like to enforce these laws. I mean, we had a very similar situation here in Ohio with our six-week ban. It had no exceptions for rape or incest. It had a very narrow and confusing, exception in terms of saving health or life of the patient. And, when these bans come up, it kind of turns out that even folks who consider themselves pretty pro-life are opposed to these laws, right? But then I think what happens is particularly the Republicans who support them try to go back to the drawing board and say, well, can we fix it? Can we make it better? And they find that there is too much disagreement within their coalition, and there's certain extreme elements who won't sign on to any sort of exceptions. So I think it really is a political problem for the folks who want to push these abortion bans, that they are so far out of the mainstream of public opinion, and yet they can't get the political will within their own party to change it.
Okay, we have got a minute left, but I want to ask quickly about Florida. So they've got the 6-week ban, but also has a constitutional amendment proposed, similar to our state's, coming up in November. So what does the climate look like there?
Yeah, I think that the 6-week ban is very unpopular, and I think it could, you know, push people to vote in favor of the amendment. One thing to be aware of in Florida is they've got to get 60%. So, you know, we kind of dodged that bullet here in Ohio, but this will be the first test to see if they can get 60% support for the amendment.
Jessie Hale, law professor at Case Western Reserve University and cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Ohio, and Susan Tebben, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. My thanks to both of you for this comprehensive conversation.
Thank you.
Happy to help.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with our education reporter, Connor Morris, about his sit-down with Youngstown State University President Bill Johnson. That's coming up. Stay with us. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for being with us this hour. Controversy has surrounded the hiring of Youngstown State University's new president, Bill Johnson. A protest was held on his first day in office because of the moves he made as a former U.S. congressman. He supported former President Donald Trump's travel ban on several Muslim countries. He voted against gay marriage and voted to overturn the 2020 presidential election. And now Johnson is tackling big issues that Youngstown State University faces, including declining enrollment and having to offer buyouts for some staff. Johnson sat down for a conversation with IdeaStream education reporter Connor Morris and spoke candidly about these topics and others. Connor is calling in this morning to talk about what he learned. Connor, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, happy to be here. Well, remotely, of course.
Yeah, we'll take you anyway. So thanks for the conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question for Connor, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Connor, I'm curious, why for you was getting an interview with Bill Johnson so compelling?
Yeah, I mean, it's a number of reasons. You know, like you said, his hiring was controversial, of course, even outside of his former political career. Folks were kind of upset at the way that the trustees at YSU had engaged in it was like a closed door search process to hire him. We sometimes see these in higher ed, not that common, but you know, it does happen. And faculty and students and folks were up in arms about there weren't really any campus visits for many of the candidates. They never even said who the other candidates were. They were just like, this is the guy, and by the way, he's a former, you know, GOP congressman. And also too, you know, it's unusual a bit for politicians to be hired on as university presidents. And he's also, you know, as I mentioned, a GOP politician. That is, you know, honestly, even a little more unusual. Conservative commentators and even Johnson himself, I followed him on Facebook for years, Facebook page as a congressman. He's railed before on, you know, how biased college campuses are in favor of liberals or liberal aligned causes. So it's kind of interesting to see that higher ed is what's next for him. Also, he did live in Marietta for a long while and represented Marietta, and that's where I was born. So.
So that was compelling to you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious, did the university ever give kind of clarity that you thought was kind of definitive when it came to, and yet we're very pleased with Bill Johnson as the president to be for our administration?
Yeah. The trustees were pretty, for the most part, there was only one of them that did not vote for you know, his hire. The trustee chair said he was just the best candidate for the job. He represented the area for a long time. He was, you know, represented, you know, Eastern and Southern Ohio. And so they felt he knew the area well. They felt that he could effectively, you know, advocate for the university. That is kind of an angle, you know, might be part of the calculus for some universities is, well, you know, politicians know the system well, and so they could probably effectively advocate for us, and could be good fundraisers as well. So those were all kind of elements that came into play. And they said also, you know, we had this closed door process so we can get the, you know, quote unquote, best talent. So, you know, and they were afraid that sometimes universities will often argue with these closed door processes that, oh, we don't want to scare people away, essentially.
So let's get to Johnson himself. You know, he received a lot of the condemnation for his politics. How did he talk about that time when he was kind of the candidate that was going to get the job? And how did he say that it would approach his presidency?
Yeah, so he said, you know, since he was hired on, that he would, you know, he would leave the politicking behind. He would try to, you know, do his best to, you know, provide, you know, leadership, that, you know, stewardship for all students. So, you know, but he also told me when I talked to him more recently that he doesn't have the luxury like other presidents do of kind of being able to put his political views in a box and hide it away. You know, people do know he's stood pretty proudly, you know, in terms of his, you know, votes, you know, in line with former President Donald Trump. You know, as you mentioned, you know, he voted against that Respect for Marriage Act, which codifies same-sex in marriages. And he's, you know, always been pro-fossil fuel, big booster for the oil and gas industry. But he said, look, you know, he voted for the kind of majority opinion of the folks in the region he served. So he was stood by that. He said, you know, I'm not going to – I still, you know – he still has those values, but it's not, he says it's not going to impact the way that he approaches his job. He still wants what's best for everyone, essentially. So that was kind of interesting for sure. And he also said that, you know, so there were students on campus, you know, when they there was a protest when he was hired, and folks were, they were concerned about, you know, would support for international students wane, you know, would there be something that is done around, you know, support for students of color, LGBTQ students. And he said, look, I want all students to feel welcome on campus. So he's trying to strike kind of an interesting balance there.
Mm-hmm. And then, now, you know, he's got the job, and in the most, you know, vital aspect of the university is their education. So how did he talk about how he wanted to teach the students at Youngstown?
Yeah, so when he was hired, he said he wanted to educate students and not indoctrinate them. And that's a common term from conservative commentators who are critical of colleges and schools. They allege that they're biased against conservatives. We've got a clip here from him talking a little bit more about this, about how he wants faculty to kind of toe the line that he's towing.
Teach them calculus. Teach them art. Teach them music. Teach them algebra. Teach them history. Teach them the core curriculum. Teach them the things that they need to know how to think critically so that they can address the challenges of their day. Because their challenges in this very dynamic world that we live in are going to be different from the challenges that you and I face in our lifetime. The world changes, right? So we need to teach them how to think, not teach them what to think. I think fair is fair. If you want the president to not play politics, everybody else ought to play the same way.
So that's interesting. He's saying apply the same kind of, you know, standards that you have on me with the students in how we're teaching them. What did you get from that comment?
Yeah, I think that it's going to be, I'd really be curious to see. I haven't gotten a chance to follow up with the faculty there since my conversation. But I mean, there could be some concerns regarding academic freedom there for faculty. You know, I mean, part of college and part of some of these higher level courses is you're really examining things that are controversial. You know, critical race theory, folks always say it's not taught in K-12, but it is, you know, a theory that could be discussed in a college classroom, you know, and that's the idea that racism is kind of baked into the structures of American society. And so, you know, would that standard that he's citing there, would that apply to a professor who's teaching that? You know, I don't know.
That's interesting. Good point. Let's talk about enrollment, a big issue at many universities of many different levels, including at Youngstown State. Tell me more about how that is playing out on this particular campus.
Yeah, so he's coming in at a very interesting time. I mean, colleges and universities across the country are seeing, you know, as we talked about before, enrollment declining seriously since, you know, 2010 or so or before. And, you know, YSU, same thing. You know, they've lost about 4,000 students. They've got, you know, about 11,000 students now. And, you know, they're kind of in a tough spot. But Johnson said that they are, you know, in a decent financial position. He said that, you know, they also just recently, and this has happened before his kind of time. It happened like right after he got on, but this was like a 3-year process of the university reviewing kind of low enrolled programs, and the university cut, you know, 5 low enrolled programs and offered buyouts to 13 staff. And he said that's, those are not budget cuts. That's part of like a process that we're doing to really try to be responsible, you know, stewards of, you know, taxpayer dollars. We, if there aren't that many people, you know, enrolled in these programs, then, you know, we're probably going to need to cut them. So those were in the realm of like geography, music and arts. And, you know, folks on campus were upset about that for sure. They were saying that, look, we weren't given the tools we needed for these programs to be successful. So that's why you're seeing that low enrollment, you know. So that was an interesting interplay there.
Johnson has a plan to encourage new students to Youngstown. Let's hear a clip from him talking about that.
We're a restricted enrollment school, which means you got to have a 17 on the ACT and a 2.0 to be fully admitted to Youngstown State University. What about those people, the Bill Johnsons of our region, because I was like some of those folks. What about the ones that are close but not quite there, but it's of no fault of their own? It's not that they're not smart enough to handle the work. They've just never had the opportunity or the mentoring to be able to get there. We're going after those students with a program that I call the Penguin Prep Program, modeled similarly to what our military service academies do.
So tell me more about Penguin Prep and that approach.
Yeah. So he was the U.S. Air Force for 27 years and said he nominated a lot of folks to some of these academies. The idea is it's like a college prep program for area high schoolers whose scores just aren't really there yet, and engaging some of the Honors College folks at YSU to teach them as well. So it's an interesting idea there. His whole pitch has been to try to get at some of those non-traditional students or students who might not traditionally be considering college. So, and that might be where higher ed needs to go, honestly, in terms of, because the traditional pool of college-age students, you know, is shrinking with declining birth rates, so.
And I know we've got a couple minutes left, Connor, but I know that there was a situation with Eastern Gateway Community College shuttering enrollment, Youngstown positioning itself to maybe be relevant in that way.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. So this is a community college with locations in Steubenville and Youngstown. Lots of financial issues there. They're very likely going to close unless, you know, there's a Hail Mary that happens. And so YSU and a lot of other area institutions are trying to enroll those students. There's about 7,000 students that are kind of left without a paddle after that college closes, or if it does close. And so YSU is saying, hey, we're going to open a campus in Steubenville. We're going to, and they say, you know, they don't know where, but there obviously is probably going to be a building that is laying open there. And they're also, you know, Johnson talked a little about this. If we got time for the cut, we can go to.
Yeah, let's play it.
Cool. For workforce credentials, certifications, and associate's degrees, we can bring people into those programs, and we're in the process of standing up programs to mirror what Eastern Gateway was doing so that we can provide that seamless path.
So definitely Johnson seems to be in some respects focused on, you know, how do you position Youngstown State to have sustained enrollment, continued growth. So a lot of work that he's got on his plate.
Oh, absolutely. And he said that, look, our enrollment probably will be up, and that will be up for the first time in years because of Eastern Gateway closing. So that is putting them in a pretty good position, even as it is unfortunate for that institution. So.
An interesting sit-down that you had with Bill Johnson, IdeaStream Education reporter Connor Morris. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jenny. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter now, X at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_ or on Instagram at @JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, it's been almost a year since Akron Public Schools expanded its pilot program of banning students' cell phones during the school day to 13 middle and high schools. We're going to check in on how that policy has been working and discuss the greater idea of how phone use and social media impacts young people. And we're going to meet some inspiring octogenarians recently honored in this year's Crane's 8 over 80 Awards. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for listening today, and I will speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.